You're listening to DTFHN for August 17th, 2026. I'm your unlicensed and unbothered host, Jack Hacksman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website droungers who have never met will spend a Friday afternoon fixing something nobody asked them to fix. Today is about what happens when you can open the lid. Let's get into it. I built a system once where the retry logic had no upper bound. It worked perfectly. Until it hit a transient failure and spent 4 hours retrying something that would never succeed. The code was correct. The default was insane. Simon Willison spent Friday with Qwen 3.827b. And he found the same shape of problem. Apache 2 license vision capable, 27 billion parameters. Which is the sweet spot for a laptop, 17 gigabytes on disk in the Q4 quant. He ran it on an M5 Max MacBook Pro and on a DGX Spark. Now the constraints. Qwen ships this model with reasoning effort set to extra high by default, not medium, not low. The setting label. And I quote the docs. For complex tasks demanding thorough analysis, that's the factory setting for every prompt you type. The first thing that broke was context. LM Studio defaults to 8,000 tokens, and the model burned through all of them thinking about trivial problems before it produced a single character of output. Willison bumped it to the full 262,000 token window. Then, he asked for his standard test, a pelican riding a bicycle in SVG. 21 minutes, 22,000 reasoning tokens to produce 3,000 tokens of actual output, a 7-to-1 ratio of deliberation to work. And the result was the best local model pelican he's ever gotten. Correct frame geometry. Legs on both sides of the bike, which almost never happens. Wings extending to touch the handlebars. Motion lines behind the bird, rather than in front. A background with a sun and flowers. He turned reasoning off entirely and ran it again. 3,700 tokens, 137 seconds. 2 minutes instead of 21. Then he asked it to draw a circle. The reasoning trace opens with the model deciding that a circle is insufficient and that what the user really wants is a geometric circle study with concentric compass guides, tick marks, a gradient fill, a slowly rotating dashed ring, and a pulsing glow. It pauses to consider whether it should respect prefers reduced motion. Here's the part that matters, because the weights are open, this is fixable at every layer. Two separate commenters have already forked llama.cpp. One injecting text at token thresholds to steer the reasoning process. One exposing the effort parameter directly, and patching the chat template so it stops invalidating the KV cache. A bad default in a closed model is a support ticket. A bad default in an open one is a Friday afternoon. 17 gigabytes, running on hardware you own, reasoning at roughly the level of last year's Frontier. One commenter is skipping the GPU purchase entirely. The knob is right there. Turn it down. Now, the regulatory conversation. Because the code shipping today is only half the story. The other half is who gets to decide what you're allowed to run. What if the most decentralizing thing in the room isn't the code at all, but the process that decides who gets to run it? That's the question Dario Amodei is actually asking, and it deserves a straight answer rather than a reflex. His argument goes like this. The Silicon Valley shorthand, regulation equals regulatory capture equals concentrated power. Is too crude. Institutions at their best. Vest power in ideas rather than people. He points to the courts. Stuffy, elitist, slow, and still better at defending a vulnerable individual than a mob. And he's got receipts on the specifics. SB 53 exempts anyone under $500 million in revenue entirely. The testing regimes he's pushing at Casey apply harder scrutiny to frontier models than to the ones catching up. Pacing the frontier, in his preferred implementation, throttles the leaders and leaves the challengers alone. He's describing a handicap system that taxes the incumbent. And he runs an incumbent. Now hold that up against the bootstrapism test. Not what the rule intends. Who can actually touch the thing afterward? Because there's a claim buried in there worth pulling on. Amodei says open weights aren't a sufficient answer to concentration, since they just shift power to whoever owns the compute, which is half right. And the half he skips is the part that matters. A model you can download runs on hardware you already have, gets quantized by someone in a bedroom, gets fine-tuned for a language no lab would ever prioritize. The compute floor keeps falling because thousands of people are attacking it in parallel for free. That's not a shifted bottleneck. That's a bottleneck under active siege. And the top comment on this thread cuts closest. It's a crisis of trust. Ordinary people don't trust companies or governments or the tech industry, and they assume the whole arrangement is being cooked up somewhere they can't see. You can write the fairest revenue exemption ever drafted, and it won't touch that, because the exemption still arrives from above. Trust isn't legislated. It's earned by handing people something they can inspect. The genuinely interesting version of Amodei's proposal is one where the tests themselves are open. Published methodology, reproducible by anyone with a laptop and patience. Rules you can audit are rules that decentralize. Rules you can only receive are just a different set of hands on the switch. Moving on. One commenter did the whole review in a single line. The device is endorsed by Dr. Oz, Andrew Huberman, and Robert Kennedy Jr. And the comment continues, anything endorsed by that last name must be great. That's the entire evidentiary discussion. And honestly, it's not wrong. When your endorsement roster reads like a bingo card of people who have monetized certainty, the product is telling on itself. The thing in question is the Q-collar. It's a horseshoe you wear around your neck that gently compresses the jugular veins, so more blood pools inside your skull, so your brain sloshes less when someone hits you. Sold to football players and their parents. And it carries FDA clearance, which people hear as FDA approval. Here's the analogy that clarifies it. Restaurant health inspections. An inspector walks through your kitchen and confirms the walk-in is cold and the sinks work. What they have certified is that you probably will not poison anyone. What they have not certified is that the food is good. Now imagine printing inspector recommended across the top of your menu in gold foil. Technically, every word is true. Every single diner reads it wrong. FDA clearance for this class of device means substantially equivalent to something already on the market and unlikely to hurt you. It is a plumbing check. The gold foil got added later by marketing and then laundered through podcasts where an authoritative voice says jugular compression and everyone's shoulders relax. The underlying evidence is a handful of small studies, some funded by the manufacturer, measuring changes in brain imaging rather than changes in whether teenagers get concussed, which brings up the part that's actually fixable. Nobody outside can replicate this, because the data isn't there to replicate. The raw imaging, the subject-level results, the pre-registration, locked in the same building as the people selling the collar. That's the failure mode, and it's architectural, not moral. A closed evidence base can only ever be trusted or distrusted. It can never be checked. Meanwhile, the open science community has spent 15 years building exactly the machinery that would settle this in an afternoon. Public repositories, pre-regir. Replication networks, people who volunteer their weekends to rerun someone else's numbers. The tools exist. The statisticians are willing. What's missing is the data. And the reason it's missing is that somebody sells collars. Now here's something completely different. Pause, a hardware engineer in the global south, hands on actual silicon, pushing back on the RISC-V critics. Let's hear it. Except it doesn't, and the reason is beautiful. You don't ship one chip. You ship a reel. The $200 freight is fixed. It's the same whether the box holds 30 parts or 3,000. So the freight divides out, and what's left standing is the per unit cost, multiplied by every student in every classroom you ever want to reach. 10 cents times 30 is $3. $1 times 30 is 30. That's the difference between every kid holding silicon and every kid watching one demo board from the back row. And now, the part I actually want to admire. Grinberg does something genuinely rigorous in that piece. He asks what a cheap microcontroller core is really for. Sitting inside an SD card or a USB stick. Prodding registers while custom silicon does the actual work. From that, he derives the requirements cleanly. Low interrupt latency, small die area, tight code density, because ROM and SRAM cost money per byte. No divider, maybe no multiplier, no privilege separation, because nothing untrusted ever runs there. It's a lovely piece of first principles reasoning. Then he writes the sentence himself. But you might say, you just described RV32EC. He derived the chip, and then spent the rest of the piece irritated that the chip exists. So here's the question nobody in that thread wanted to sit with. If an open instruction set is what makes a 10-cent part possible, and a 10-cent part is what puts hardware in 30 hands instead of one, then who exactly is the architecture to pay for, not for the classroom? The classroom already got what it needed. That 10-cent chip proves openness makes things cheaper and more available. Now, what happens when a company adds something to your words that you didn't put there? Anthropic is shipping a watermark that works by biasing which word comes next. Not a hidden character. Not metadata. The actual word choice. Nudged, token by token, toward a secret list, so that later a statistical test can look at a paragraph and say, this came from a machine, probably. John Gruber calls that a perversion of writing. He says he demands the most precise word at every decision point, and a system that trades away even a fraction of that precision for provenance is unacceptable. The engineers in the commons took that apart quickly, and they were right too. There is no single best next token. The model does not know the perfect word and then discard it. It produces a distribution. Thousands of candidates with probabilities attached, and then samples. Every time you've used a chat model, randomness already picked between roughly equally good options. The watermarking technique steers that existing coin flip. It does not reach into a sentence and swap a good word for a worse one. it picks between words the model already considered interchangeable. That is the technical answer, and it settles the writing quality complaint. It does not settle the actual problem, which one commenter found in a single sentence. Verifying a watermark means sending the entire text to Anthropic. Sit with the architecture of that to answer the question, was this written by a machine? You hand your document, the draft, the letter, the manuscript, the thing you have not published, to a private company's of PI. The detector is not a tool you run. It is a service you query. The key that makes the mark readable never leaves the building, because if it did, anyone could strip the mark, closed by necessity. Run it forward 5 years, the EU regulation stands. Watermarking becomes table stakes. Now imagine a school district, a court, an employer, a publisher, each with a verification pipeline pointed at a handful of corporate endpoints, every suspect document flowing through them, the detection infrastructure for written language held by the same companies that generate it. The open weights world does not have this problem, and it also does not have this feature. You can strip a watermark from a model you control. That is what control means. Which tells you the honest thing about this whole scheme. It is not a technology of truth. It is a technology of compliance. And it only works on the people who are already inside the fence. The word choice was never the story. The endpoint is. Watermarks are one way to track what's real. Here's a better answer. Build the network yourself. Story 6. Reticulum. Every network you have ever used solves the routing problem the same way. It writes down where the packet came from. The IP header has a source field. It has to more or less, because the reply needs somewhere to go. And once that field exists, it is a permanent record of who was talking on every hop, forever. Addressing and identity got welded together in 1981, and nobody unwelded them. Reticulum unwelds them. A destination address isn't assigned by anybody. It's a truncated hash of a public key. You generate a key pair. You have an address. No registry. No allocation authority. No exhaustion. Collision resistance does the job IANA does, and it does it without a building in Los Angeles. Reachability comes from announce packets that propagate outward and let intermediate nodes learn a path back toward that identity. Which means the address travels with you. Move the physical hardware across a continent. Announce again. And you're reachable in seconds. Portability falls out of the math rather than being bolted on. And packets carry no source. The return path is established by the cryptography, not declared in a header. Every link is encrypted with ephemeral keys and forward secrecy, and the stack simply refuses plain text. An unencrypted packet arriving at a destination is dropped as malformed. There's no downgrade mode to attack, because there's no mode. The constraint that shapes all of this is bandwidths. Reticulum is built to run over LoRa radios, over packet radio, over serial line. Links measured in hundreds of bits per second with latency in seconds. That budget is why the design is this austere. You cannot afford a handshake-heavy protocol on a link that slow. Working within brutal limits is what produced the elegance. The readers are sharp about the limits. And they're right. Direction finding is physics. A radio that transmits can be located, and no amount of hash-based addressing changes that. Reticulum protects contents and network layer metadata, not your RF emissions. The other honest note, it's largely one maintainer carrying an enormous surface area, which is exactly why RatSpeak, a Rust reimplementation, matters as much as it does. That's the open architecture doing its job. When the spec is public and the protocol is documented, a tired maintainer is a bottleneck rather than a single point of failure. Somebody else picks up the thread. The design outlives the author. That's the whole bet, and here it's paying. Now, something completely different pause from radio protocols and spec documents to the actual words that make Claude behave like Claude. Story 7. In 1982, IBM published the BIOS source code for the PC. Not because they wanted competitors. They wanted third-party card makers to write drivers that worked. The listing went into the technical reference manual, sold at bookstores. Compaq read it, cleanroomed it, and the PC clone industry existed within 2 years. Publishing the interface layer had consequences. IBM did not choose. Anthropic publishes the system prompts for Claude.ai. Every model dated with the diffs between versions marked in bold. Opus 5, July 24th. Fable 5, June 9th. The chain runs back to Haiku 3 in July 2024. This is the instruction layer wrapped around the model before you ever type a word, and it is on a public docs page. Now, argue the other side. This is theater. The prompt is the cheapest, most disposable layer in the stack. The weights are closed. The training data is closed. The reinforcement learning is closed. Publishing the part you can rewrite on a Tuesday while sealing the part that took $100 million of compute is transparency as marketing. And there's a reader in the thread making exactly the sharper version of this point. The even-handedness instructions that used to live in the prompt appear to have been baked into the weights after Opus 4.7, behavior moving from the readable layer into the unreadable one. Published text going quiet. That objection is correct, and it still loses, for a reason IBM would recognize. The published interface generates artifacts nobody planned. Simon Willison keeps a repository that rebuilds every one of these prompts as a git commit history. So the diff is read as a changelog of intent. Another reader calls the page a slice of the Ford roadmap. You can watch a company decide in text what it wants a mind to be. That is a primary source. It exists because a docs page had dates on it. The disclosure is partial. Partial disclosure of a system this consequential still beats the alternative, which is nothing, which is what most of the field offers. And the readable layer shrinking is itself readable. You can only notice text going quiet if the text was published in the first place. One more thing worth noticing. Several readers find the prompts far longer than the guidance fenders give the rest of us, who are told to keep our own instruction files short and unspecific. The people with the most measurement wrote the most words. Draw your own conclusion. Now for something completely different. Pause. 100-year-old robot that smiled. Story 8. Gaku Tensoku. A robot that vanished. Not destroyed, not dismantled, not sold. Vanished. Osaka, 1928. Makoto Nishimura, a biologist who studied Marima. Those green algae balls that sit at the bottom of Japanese lakes doing nothing in particular for 100 years. Builds the first robot in East Asia, and the reason he builds it is a book review. Nishimura had read R.U. Carl Chait's play, the one that gave us the word robot in the first place, from the Czech for forced labor. Chait's machines were slaves who eventually rise up. And Nishimura looked at that and thought, you have gotten the premise wrong at the root. Take his objection seriously and follow it all the way down. If you build a machine as a slave, you have to build a machine that can be a slave. Which means constraint, which means an off switch someone else holds, which means the interesting design work goes into the leash rather than the mind. Nishimura's alternative was in the name. Gakutensuku. Learning from the laws of nature. He didn't want a servant. And pay attention. This is the part that's easy to scroll past. He didn't want a master either. He wanted a friend, possibly an inspirational model, a thing you could look at and want to be more like. The machine was enormous, pneumatic, air pressure driven, a face that changed expression, an arm that wrote. He toured it. Kyoto, Tokyo, Hiroshima, Korea, China, and then, in the 30s, it disappeared. One reader on the thread put it perfectly. A mystery. Someone will know. Nobody knows. The details of its disappearance are unknown. Here is what I find genuinely wonderful about that. The most influential thing Nishimura ever built was not the machine. It was the argument. The machine is gone. No schematics in a vault. No estate lawyers. No licensing regime. And yet Osaka rebuilt it in 2008 from photographs and descriptions. It runs today. Somebody looked at pictures of a lost thing and made it exist again, because the idea had been published and the idea was portable. 100 years on, we're still having Nishimura's argument. Servant or friend? Leash or model? And the people who got there first got there by writing it down and touring it through 6 cities, where anyone could walk up and look. That's the only reason we're still talking about it. Remember that lost machine somebody rebuilt from photographs? Story 9 is that same instinct, running on a Commodore 64. I built a save system, once that worked perfectly until someone actually saved. 6 slots, custom format. And I learned that the last 5% of a project is where the interesting engineering lives, because that's where the machine stops cooperating. AGI-64 is a Sierra Adventure game interpreter for the Commodore 64. Space Quest 1. Playable. On a 1 MHz machine with 64 kilobytes of RAM. Sierra never shipped AGI for the 64. And one commenter dug up the actual reason, which wasn't technical. It was market focus. The 64 was the games machine, but Sierra's adventures were aimed at the IBM and Apple crowd, at people who bought computers for work and played after hours. A business decision made in 1984 that left a gap in the shelf. 42 years later, somebody filled it. Not Sierra. Sierra is dust and Activision paperwork. Somebody with an easy flash cartridge and too much patience. The technical substance is where this gets good. AGI's graphics are vector. The original games drew backgrounds as fill and line commands, which is why they scale beautifully and why they'd murder a 6410. So, a GI-64 ships. A pre-processing tool that converts artwork ahead of time. Compiles your .vol and .obj files into a 1 MB cartridge image. And lets the 64 do the part it's good at, pushing pixels it already has. Saves go to a real 1x41 or an SD card emulating 1, drive 8, custom format, 6 slots. Note what the tool does not include. The games. You supply your own files from your own library. That's the architecture of every good preservation project. The engine is free and open, the data is yours, and nobody has to ask permission from a rights holder who has spent 3 decades not caring. Compare that to the alternative model, where a publisher releases 4 of the 6 titles, DRM'd at $9.99, running in an emulator worse than the one you'd write yourself. The comment I keep returning to is the one asking whether SCI could work. SCI is the next generation. Bigger, heavier, built for machines with an order of magnitude more room. The correct answer is probably no. The historical answer is that probably no is exactly what somebody said about AGI on the 64. And here we are, 75% of the way through Space Quest. The gap sat open for 42 years. Then one person with the source and no permission slip closed it. So what happens when the thing being resurrected isn't a 40-year-old machine, but a tool that's alive and shipping right now? Story 10. Rhombus 1.1. What does a language actually need before it can call itself customizable? Not syntax preferences, not a package registry. The real requirement is that a user can extend the language using the same tools the language authors use. No privileged tier, no compiler fork. Rhombus 1.1 shipped this month, and the changelog reads like a list of answers to that question. Rhombus is the Racket team's attempt to keep everything Racket got right about extensibility while dropping the parentheses that scared everyone away. And the headline item in this release is a form called Anote. Here's what that means. In Racket and in Rhombus until now, if you wanted to define a new type annotation, a way to say this value must satisfy these properties, you had to write meta-time code, macro-level code. You had to step up a level of abstraction into the phase where the compiler is still running and write a program that generates a program. That is a genuine skill ceiling. Most working programmers never cross it, and they shouldn't have to. So the team added anot and anot.def. Define an annotation directly at the level you're already standing on. The latter got a rung. The rest of the release has the same texture, a binding form called as, because sometimes naming a thing with double ampersand reads badly, and readability is a real engineering constraint rather than a taste. Class now binds inherited names through the actual superclass reference, which is the kind of correctness fix you only find by using your own language seriously. And in the presentation library, Magic Move and Crossfade got better at handling paragraph breaks and repeated child element. Animation plumbing, invisible when it works. I want to sit with the motto they mention because it is the whole argument compressed. The Racket team's unofficial line is, anything we can do, you can do. Not a marketing slogan, an architectural commitment that costs them something. Every capability they keep for themselves would be easier to maintain. They give it away instead, and the language gets better because a wider set of people can shape it. One commenter wonders whether AI coding will push everyone towards static types and heavy documentation. Maybe, but the interesting property here isn't the type system. It's that the extension mechanism is legible enough for a machine or a newcomer to reach. Reachable tools compound. Guarded ones don't. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 17, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen 321. TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go take the lid off something and see what's inside. We'll see you back here tomorrow.